Hey everyone, you might notice that the BetterHelp ad and my regular introduction are missing from this episode, and that is because I had a six-hour orientation to my master's program that I started this weekend that was due Monday. Unfortunately, the weekend is when I do all of this whole show. Every aspect of this show happens between Thursday night and Saturday night. So unfortunately, that 6 hours pretty much ate up all of my time that I had to make an episode for this week. But fear not, our good friend Craig from Canadian History X was willing to step in and send an episode over for us. Craig is not only an amazing podcaster and journalist, but he is absolutely a friend of the show, and he has been a supporter of this show since the before times when it was a bad show. Before the rebrand and before I started taking writing seriously, he was even a fan and supporter then. So sincerely, sincerely, I hope that you stick around and listen to Craig's episode. It is great, as are all of his episodes. I will tag his show in the show notes so that you can find his work and subscribe to his podcasts as well. Until next time, I will see you guys next week, and I promise I will have something prepared that is actually obscure history. That orientation was a bit of an unfortunate surprise, but these things happen, and as much as I do love making this podcast, it is not my career. My career does require me to have that master's degree. So anyways, I hope that you guys have a fantastic week. Please stick around for Craig's show. You will absolutely not regret it.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you like, you can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. You can also donate to the podcast by going to CanadaEHX.com and clicking donate. Don't forget, I have two other podcasts out there, Pucks and Cups, which releases every single Tuesday, and From John to Justin, which releases every single Friday. I do all these podcasts full-time, the writing, the research, everything. So every dollar you give helps keep it all going, and I truly do appreciate it, and I'll thank you on the air and throughout my social media. If you like, you can email me at craig@canadaehx.com. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is Craig Baird, CraigBaird, and I'm on Instagram and TikTok at Bairdo37. You can also find me on YouTube, where I put up weekly videos on Canada's history. Just go to youtube.com/c/CanadianHistoryX. Remember, that's EHX. First, I'd like to apologize because my voice might be a bit off. I'm right now battling through a sore throat, but I wanted to make sure that I got an episode out, so I drank some cough syrup, and I'm ready to get this episode recorded so you can all enjoy it. But I apologize if I get gravelly or my voice breaks or anything like that, because sore throats suck. It could be argued that the Avro Arrow is the most famous aircraft in Canadian history. It is famous not only for the fact it was one of the most advanced aircraft of its time, but also the unceremonious end to the Avro program that moved the aircraft into legend. Today, I'm looking at the famous Avro Arrow. By the 1950s, the Cold War was growing as a perceived threat to North America. There was a concern that Soviet bombers armed with nuclear warheads could travel to North America over the Canadian Arctic, with some experts stating such an attack could come as early as 1954. In order to deal with this perceived threat, the Royal Canadian Air Force commissioned the Avro Company to design and build a new aircraft, which would be an all-weather nuclear interceptor that could fly higher and faster than any other aircraft. It would be known as the Avro CF-105, or more commonly, the Avro Arrow. Avro Canada had been created in 1945 as a subsidiary of Hawker Siddeley Group. Initially, the company handled the repair and maintenance work for aircraft at the airport that would become the Toronto Pearson International Airport. 1 year later, the company designed Canada's first jet fighter for the Royal Canadian Air Force, the Avro CF-100 Canuck All-Weather Interceptor. It would take years for the aircraft to enter service, which it did in 1953, and it would continue to serve a role in the Canadian military until 1981. Gaining the contract to build the Arrow, Avro quickly expanded, and by 1957, the company was employing 20,000 people. This made it one of the largest companies in Canada and one of the most respected. On September 30, 1953, the company would purchase a jet plant in Malton, Ontario for $17.5 million in order to become the first Canadian company to build a complete aircraft from airframe to jet engines in its factories. an Avro spokesman would state, quote, "Never before has a Canadian company been capable of building a plane from top to bottom. We have always had to buy various parts for the aircraft. Now we can design and put one together on our own hook," end quote. Leading the project would be Avro President Crawford Gordon Jr., James C. Floyd, who was the first non-American to win the Wright Brothers Medal for his work on jet technology, and there was also Janusz Surakowski, a pilot from Poland who served during the Battle of Britain and would have the honor of flying the Arrow. The project was massive, with the plane weighing in at 20,000 kilograms with a 15.2-meter wingspan. It also had the first computerized flight control and weapon system in the world, and it was going to be faster than any jet of its type, able to hit twice the speed of sound at 53,000 feet. The electronic firing system contract would be awarded to the Radio Corporation of America, and there was a plan to produce the Arrow, called the CF-105 in Britain, under a license with the Royal Air Force. The timetable for this project, which began in 1953, was short, and instead of having a small number of prototypes hand-built and flown to test problems, the production line was set up first, and several planes were built as production models. Any changes would be incorporated into the design while testing continued, and full production would start immediately once the testing was finished.
Problems were legion on the Arrow. We had a problem, for instance, at the wing skin temperatures at 50,000 feet, where the aircraft was to have its combat capability, were 40, 50 degrees higher than the boiling point of water. Yet inside of the wing, you had the fuel, which was cooling it down. So the differential temperature was trying to distort the wing. And we had to tailor and design the wing so that that distortion was compensated and didn't affect the aerodynamic capability of the aircraft. We had to be dead right first time. There was no flying a prototype, finding the problems on it, then reflecting that back into the production drawings and issuing modifications. You had to be right, and yet you had nothing to fall back on, no real experience to fall back on the design of this aircraft.
As news reports of the new aircraft started to hit newspapers, there was speculation that the aircraft would have no pilot due to the speeds it would reach. The Regina Leader Post would report on September 16, 1955, quote, "At 1,500 miles an hour, a plane is approaching the heat barrier in which ordinary metals such as steel tend to give way. The heat is caused by friction between air and the aircraft. It is believed the pilot will have little to do than take it off and land it. That even may be done automatically," end quote. In order to deal with the heat created by the heat barrier, the Arrow carried enough refrigeration to turn out 23 tons of ice every day. It would also contain 17 kilometers of wiring, and its control mechanism was powerful enough to lift 6 elephants standing in an elevator. In order to test the plane, 9 models of 1/8 size were launched on rockets over Lake Ontario, and 2 others over the Atlantic Ocean. These models flew at Mach 1.7 and were initially crashed into the water. Around the time tests were beginning, there was a worry that the funding from the government would be cut. The government had nearly lost $60 million that it had invested in 2 post-Korean defense projects, which included the Avro Arrow program, and it was a drastic action by the government that prevented the failure of the 2 projects and the money already invested. One of the first tests took place on August 25, 1955, when a miniature was mounted on the nose of a Nike anti-aircraft missile and sent to supersonic speeds to 24 kilometers in the air, and then sent back down after it was released from the missile. At the same time, another model was mounted in a wind tunnel in Buffalo and flown at speeds equaling 1,600 kilometers an hour. This method of testing the plane also had risks, which meant a massive testing program was needed to mitigate the risks. By the middle of 1954, wind tunnel work began on the plane, as well as computer simulation studies. The experiments showed that only a small number of design changes were needed, and most of those were changes in positioning and profile of the wings. In October of 1954, it was announced that the new Avro Arrow would be ready for output by 1956, according to R.K. Anderson, in speaking with an international meeting of 250 scientists, engineers, and technicians. While he did not state it was the Arrow, most interpreted it to be so. In February 1956, a full-scale wooden mock-up was created, and the Royal Canadian Air Force soon demanded changes, including changes to the fire control system. All of this work came to fruition on October 4, 1957, when the Avro Arrow was unveiled in front of 12,000 people at the Avro plant. Ian Austin, a journalist in attendance, would state, quote, Its swept back delta wings and early electronic flight controls gave it a look of tomorrow, as did its blinding white, matte black, and day glow orange paint. End quote. Of course, what a lot of people didn't know was that the plane was literally just painted, and one stenographer at the unveiling found that the paint was still wet on the jet. Air Vice Marshal Hugh Campbell would say, quote, "The Aero, including its missiles, flight trail, and fire control systems, we believe will become a very important component of North American air defense." End quote.
In Canada, the wraps were taken off one of the most ambitious aviation ventures ever undertaken in this country, the Avro Company's CF-105, or as it's called, the Aero. Without intercontinental ballistic missiles, the CF-105 was scheduled to be the most important instrument of air defense for the next 10 years. Now, this may not be so. In any case, when the Aero does go into service, it will compete with any manned fighter anywhere in the world.
One concern was raised about the plane on the first day, and that was the noise it would generate. Finding a base for the planes would be difficult, considering that anyone living within 4 kilometers of the plane taking off would find it quite bothersome. Another issue was that due to its speed, it gobbled up fuel and could only fly for about 40 minutes, but in that time it could cover a distance from Toronto to Halifax. On the first day that the plane was unveiled, there was already talk of whether or not it would still be useful. The Calgary Herald would write, quote, "Will the Aero, which will not be in squadron service until 1961, be outdistanced soon by rockets? This is the real contest the Aero faces, not against Russian bombers, which she can magnificently demolish, but against the timescale of rocket missilery, which is rapidly compressing her useful fighting life." End quote. The same article would highlight that the program was under review, but that it would likely be safe from cuts. The article stated, quote, "It should be said, if only for the benefit of the 20,000 Canadians whose jobs depend on the project, that in the current defense economy, drive the Aero is as safe as a church." End quote. There was also concern over the fact that the Aero was capable of carrying a nuclear bomb, and many questioned whether or not Canada should be involved in building bombers. The Ottawa Citizen's headline would highlight this, stating, quote, "Avro's new jet is platform for launching H-bombs," end quote. Zurakowski, the man who would fly her on the first flight, would say, quote, "She'll do, easy to fly. She'll be the easiest flying plane ever built," end quote. With the plane unveiled, it now fell to Zurakowski to fly for the first time. On March 25, 1958, at 9:53 a.m., the plane took flight and demonstrated excellent handling. The Windsor Star would write, quote, "Today's flight relieved months of tension for Avro designers and engineers. The Aero snapped a hydraulic line Saturday, minutes before it was scheduled to take off, and it took most of Monday to repair and inspect the plane," end quote. Zurakowski, in very few words, would simply say, quote, "It's a beauty," end quote.
"It's coming up now, slowly taxiing southwards towards the end of a 2-mile runway. I can see Avro's famous test pilot, Jan Zurakowski, looking small under the canopy of this great long aircraft. It's rather difficult to imagine how this aircraft will fly, because from this angle, as I look at the side fuselage, it does not appear to have wings, only a large, high tail. It's continuing its taxiing down the runway, very quietly, by the way. Very little noise from the motor. Now the plane has disappeared over a small hummock which obscures my view of the end of the runway. So I suppose in any moment we can expect the CF-105, the Avro Aero, to come rushing up the runway and take off. I hear a sound. This is it. This is it. Here she comes. It's off the ground. That's it. Magnificent and thrilling sight.
like a great dart, taking to the air at a 45-degree angle, followed by the two chase planes. Well, there it is. I suppose that took place at about 8 minutes before 10 o'clock. Here's just passing over, and it's banking. Just passing over above us, I estimate the height to be somewhere around about 800 feet. Followed very closely by one of the chase planes. The chase plane, by the way, is photographing every movement on motion picture film, of course. There goes the second chase plane following behind.
Today, I'm excited to announce that one of the best scripted drama podcasts is returning for its third season. The Mermaid and the Lion, a show about two imperfect people working to perfect their love for one another, is back. These days, staying married forever is an anomaly, but those who make it through have quite the stories to tell of the highs and lows of being together. The Mermaid and the Lion follows Angel and Gazza, who believe they are on the right path to making it last, but that comes from understanding where they have been, what brought them together, and what keeps them in love. On The Mermaid and the Lion, you can follow Angel and Gazza as they go through all the drama, sex, trust issues, pain, growth, and friendship. The Mermaid and the Lion, an epic journey to death do us part, returning for a third season this November on all podcast platforms. Through the next 12 months, this first version of the Avro Arrow would fly 66 times. On the plane's third flight, it went supersonic, and on its seventh flight, it broke 1,600 kilometers an hour at 50,000 feet while climbing. A top speed of Mach 1.98 was reached, but that was the limit of what it was capable of. A Mark II was in development at the time, but unfortunately, it would never fly. As it turned out, those initial flights would be the high point for the Arrow, and it would be all downhill from there. In fact, the end would begin only a week later, but I'll get to that. Changes were afoot in Canada when in June 1957, Louis Saint-Laurent and the Liberals lost to the charismatic John Diefenbaker and the Progressive Conservatives, ending 22 years of Liberal rule dating back to 1935. Diefenbaker had made cutbacks to federal spending a major part of his campaign, and now that he was in power with a minority government, he wanted to make good on that. The Avro Arrow program was not cheap, costing $400 million or $3.7 billion today, and it was diverting huge funds from the Air Force. There were other issues. Lieutenant General Guy Simmons felt that the technology used in the Arrow was already outdated, and Diefenbaker did not get along with Crawford Gordon Jr. Diefenbaker did not drink, or did so very rarely, while Gordon was known to enjoy smoking and drinking. The two men would often argue and never saw eye to eye. Another problem came from the Soviets themselves. The very day that the Avro Arrow was unveiled, Sputnik was launched into orbit. With the first human-made satellite, the focus on nuclear weapons moved from the air and into space, and the idea of a piloted bomber became less of a concern compared to intercontinental ballistic missiles. If the Avro Arrow, which was designed to intercept Soviet bombers, was not going to be used for that now, what would it be used for? The Avro Arrow remained the fastest jet in the world, but France, Sweden, Great Britain, and the United States had all created planes that could fly longer and higher. The Americans were working to build their own F-106, which was similar to the Arrow, and their plane was only 2 to 3 years away from full production, the same as the Arrow was. With the world changing fast and the jet not being ready for combat until 1962, the writing seemed to be on the wall for the program. There is also belief that the United States pressured Diefenbaker to cancel the Avro Arrow program, as it was seen as a competitor to the American companies. The truth is that this has become a myth that has grown over the years, but is likely not rooted in much fact. The United States Air Force in 1958 at least had wanted to buy Arrows on behalf of the Royal Canadian Air Force to serve in continental defense. Canada refused this, believing it was an act of charity. With pressure mounting, the company tried to find a foreign buyer for the Avro Arrow, but countries did not want to take on the project, especially with the space age now dawning. On March 31, 1958, Diefenbaker would win the largest majority in Canadian history, and that would prove to be the beginning of the end for the Avro Arrow. On April 22, 1958, the Defense Research Board advised the government that the Arrow would be a useful weapon system for the next several years. What many were waiting on was news on what the Russians were doing. Such a government decision could be changed overnight if intelligence reports out of Russia provided reliable information that the Soviet Union planned to halt bomber production soon. End quote. On August 11, 1958, George Perks, the Minister of National Defense, requested that the Aero program be canceled, but the Cabinet Defense Committee refused to do so. In September, Perks again put forward the request and included the installation of Bismarck missile systems as part of the NORAD treaty Canada had signed in 1957. The committee accepted the installation of the missile system, but again refused to cancel the Avro Aero program. The committee wanted to wait until a major review on March 31, 1959.
I want to stress most emphatically that the Aero program has not been canceled, nor has it been decided not to put it into production. On the contrary, the Prime Minister's statement says the program is to continue. As it now stands, it involves the building of 37 aircraft and an appropriate number of engines. This situation remains unchanged, and we are convinced that when the review takes place next March, the Aero will be ordered into production.
Even as the government was calling for the program to be canceled, the plane was still making news for its abilities. On August 2nd, the second Avro Aero took flight and remained in the air for 75 minutes. The second Aero came along only a few weeks after the first Aero was damaged when parts of its landing gear failed upon landing. On August 27th, the second Aero hit 1,400 kilometers an hour as it was tested for instrumentation and structure, reaching 50,000 feet. On August 29th, the plane blasted through the sound barrier 45,000 feet above Ottawa, causing many in Ottawa to believe an explosion had occurred. Despite these successes, the end was near for the plane, and it would come suddenly. By March 1959, it was expected six Aeros would be completed, but those planes would never take proper flight. On February 20, 1959, the project was cancelled, and overnight, 14,528 people were out of work directly at Avro, while another 15,000 people in the supply chain of Avro would lose their jobs. Many were highly skilled engineers. The day would become known as Black Friday in the Canadian aviation industry.
Shortly after the news of the dismissals had been broadcast over the public address system at the Avro plant at Malton, Bill Beattie of CBC News in Toronto was at the scene. He's beside me in the studio now. What were your impressions of the scene, Bill?
Well, it's a many-sided story, this death of the Arrow. At Malton, a funeral procession of cars, hundreds of them, bumper to bumper, along the roads leading from the plant at closing time. You are about to hear a recording of the words from some bitter, shocked people. Jobs gone, futures uncertain. These are the people who left Avro this night. Toolmakers, designers, maintenance men, office workers. Listen.
Everybody's just shocked. Just stunned.
No warning whatsoever. We were just working and they put it over the loudspeaker that everybody else on now was laid off. The plant is just shut down and we're finished as from tonight.
Everybody's
stunned. Well, it was like a shock. We were stunned, everybody.
Everybody.
What are you going to do now?
Sign on the labor exchange and wait and see what comes along.
There isn't very much for anyone to do nowadays.
How long did you work to the plant?
6 years.
I've been there 6 years. Gentleman here, 13 years.
19 years,
yeah. And he's just put out like an old sack.
John Diefenbaker isn't any good. That's my opinion.
Well, it's unfortunate. The way it had to be broken up this way, and it can't be helped.
We've had our course.
What do you think of it?
Well, it was quite a disappointment. People are living on hope. They figured that there would be something come out of it, you know, that they wouldn't get cut so drastically.
Well, we've been expecting this, but we didn't expect it so soon.
What do you think of the news today?
Oh, wonderful. Good fishing now.
You think you'll just go fishing?
I think we'll have to for a few days.
What are you going to do now?
Take the boat back to school.
I'm going to draw my unemployment right till the last draw. Diefenbaker ain't going to get it.
There's nothing wrong with Diefenbaker. It's the minute before Diefenbaker it was out.
That's right.
That's what I say.
I say there's too much Americanism and not enough Canadianism in the country, and we're fast becoming a satellite of the Americans.
How long have you been at the plant?
17 years.
Well, I think it's drastic. I think that the government have shown a disregard for the economy. Well, I wouldn't say actually the economy, but for the good and welfare of the people alone. I didn't think it would have been collapsed right immediately. I figured they might have done something to facilitate other workers and the ailing people in the plant. Like this man here is a cripple. He's got no legs. And I think it's a tragedy completely, and it'll learn people that the only party for the Canadian people is a CCF party.
Well, there you have the collective voices of personal disillusion. Avro working people recorded at random as they drove out from Avro for the last time. Employees were told this afternoon to take away all personal belongings from the plant.
General Charles Foulkes, the chairman of the Canadian Chiefs of Staff, would say the end came because of the high cost and lack of foreign orders, stating, quote, "Therefore, because of these reasons, it is now possible that we may have to abandon the policy of developing and producing special Canadian equipment for the limited requirements of the Canadian forces," end quote. Diefenbaker would issue a statement regarding the cancellation later in the day on February 20th. He would state, quote, "By the middle 1960s, the missile seemed likely to be the major threat, and the long-range bomber relegated to supplementing the major attack by these missiles. This decision is a vivid example of the fact that a rapidly changing defense picture requires difficult decisions, and the government regrets the inevitable impact of it upon production, employment, and engineering work in the aircraft and related industries," end quote. Prime Minister Diefenbaker would add, quote, "The examination had been made in light of all information available concerning the probable nature of threats to North America in future years, the alternative means defense, and the estimated costs. The conclusion is that the development of the Arrow should be terminated now," end quote.
Well, Mr. Diefenbaker, what were the main factors behind the government's decision with regard to the Arrow?
Well, as far back as 1952, when the plan first got underway, it was realized that from time to time it would be subject to examination with a view to ascertaining whether or not this type of interceptor would be the proper instrument. Last September, I made it perfectly clear that having regard to the development that was then taking place, particularly in intercontinental ballistic missiles, that there was a probability that action would have to be taken in this regard. And that's the reason for the action. We were loath to take it, but responsibility rested upon us to assure that the defense dollar expended in Canada shall return the largest potential in defense. And that having regard to the change in attitude of the USSR in devoting itself more and more to missiles, we found that the defense that would be available to Canada by 1962, when these aircraft would first be available in general for the RCAF, by that time, they would be ineffectual and inoperative if the missiles had been advanced as we expect they will.
Diefenbaker would then make it clear that Canada would go ahead with the installation of Bomarc anti-aircraft missile systems, which would be fitted with nuclear warheads. Avro management was completely caught off guard by the cancellation. They had known that the program was in jeopardy, but they had expected it not to come before the March review. They had hoped to fly the Arrow Mark II before cancellation to set new world speed and altitude records. Crawford Gordon Jr. would state, quote, "We've received wires from the government instructing us to cease all work immediately on the Arrow and the Iroquois program at Malton, and by all suppliers and subcontractors. As a result, notice of termination of employment is being given to all employees. We profoundly regret this action, but we have no alternative since the company received no prior notice of the decision, and therefore, we were unable to plan any orderly adjustment," end quote. The Avro management and employees were not the only ones caught off guard by the decision. The House of Commons was shocked as well. The Ottawa Journal would report, quote, "It was evident by the hush that fell over the House this morning that the members had not expected the pronouncement of the Arrow death sentence almost 6 weeks ahead of deadline," end quote. Liberal leader Lester B. Pearson would call for a complete review of defense policy in light of the cancellation. He would state, quote, "Where are we going from now on in this vital matter?" End quote.
And my first reaction was that the decision to end the production of the Arrow was announced in Parliament today, 20 months after the government came into power. It's a decision important for defense, but it's important also industrially and economically for Canada. Canadian development is to be ended, and a United States-produced missile is to take its place. We, in the official opposition, will judge this decision by our considered view of the effect it will have on our security and on our economic and industrial development. One thing has been made clear by today's announcement. the absolute necessity of a searching and complete examination by a parliamentary committee or subcommittee of the whole question of defense policy. Where do we go from here? Far more than the Arrow is involved in this matter, which must surely mean that if the planning and operational side is to be collective with the United States, the development of resources and industrial capacity must be collective also. We are approaching other vitally important decisions in defense policy. The Parliament, we think, is entitled to far more information than it has received if the decisions which will have to be made are to be on a broad basis of agreement, as I hope they can be.
We think it was a very serious decision. It means that Canadians in the last few years have been taxed to the extent of $400 million, and this money has now been wasted according to the government. It is also serious because it will result in unemployment of perhaps between 40 and 50,000 Canadians. The CCF call on the government to enunciate an alternative employment program for the people involved. We ask the government to increase pressure on the United States for increased defense orders for Canada, and we say that our country should make a greater effort for positive peace by cooperating with other nations in a war against disease and poverty around the world.
An attempt was made to provide the completed Avro Arrows to the National Research Council of Canada as test aircraft, but the council refused because it did not have a ready supply of spare parts or staff and pilots trained for the plane. By July of 1959, all of the aircraft had been cut to pieces with blowtorches while the blueprints, models, designs, and more were destroyed. The Victoria Times columnist reported, quote, "The remains were left on a concrete flight apron to be taken away and disposed of as scrap metal," end quote.
Within 2 months of Black Friday, 5 completed Arrows and 6 more in the final stages of production were demolished. Mrs. Kay Shaw was there. She had been senior design draftsman on the Arrow project.
Cancellation of a military item is always a possibility. We had known that right from the beginning. The February the 20th announcement not only canceled all that, but shortly afterwards ordered the destruction of all the completed planes, the almost completed planes, all the tools, jigs, and fixtures, all the documents, the research and development data, films, pictures, records, practically everything that could indicate that that plane ever existed. That was an act of obscenity that nobody has been able to explain. We saw the destruction of the planes that were in the shop. The first 3 Mark II Arrows with the Iroquois engines were practically ready to roll. They were expected to, the first one was expected to roll out in 2 or 3 days. We saw those being cut up, saw the records and the documents and the studies being collected and piled into garbage carts to be taken away to be destroyed. The 5 aircraft out on the tarmac, no one believed that they would be destroyed. Britain had asked to buy the 5 completed Arrows, and the British Aeronautical Institute wanted them so badly that they almost made a political issue out of it. All that was thrown down the drain. Everything was cut up for scrap.
Hamilton scrap dealer Sam Lax faithfully carried out the orders relayed to him by the Department of Defense Production. The Arrow became ingots, which eventually were melted down for pots and pans.
Rumors swirled that Diefenbaker ordered all evidence of the plane's merits destroyed to avoid future embarrassment, while others said it was for security reasons. Others would say that the CIA were involved in terminating the Arrow and removing any trace of it because it could outperform their own top-secret U-2 spy plane. A legend emerged that Air Marshal W.A. Curtis had hidden away an Arrow for prosperity. In 1968, he was asked if the rumor was true, and he would state, quote, "I don't want to answer that," end quote. While no intact full-sized Avro Arrow has never been found, the legend persists that there is one somewhere in Canada hidden away. As it is 2021 and everyone involved with the program has passed away for the most part, it's likely the rumor is not true. Diefenbaker has also become the symbol of the demise of the program, especially at the time. Blair Fraser of Maclean's would write, quote, "Never, not even in June 1957, has Prime Minister Diefenbaker met the press with such well-earned glee as when he announced the discontinuation of our all-Canadian supersonic fighter aircraft, the Avro Arrow," end quote. Charles Lynch of the Ottawa Citizen stated, quote, "I, for one, am convinced the program would have been carried through but for Mr. Diefenbaker's open hatred for the Avro Company, which he regarded as a pork barrel operation," end quote. Since then, historians have come to believe that the program would have been canceled even with the liberals in power, as it had come along when the world was changing and the type of aircraft, for its cost, was no longer viable. Diefenbaker would say of the program, quote, "It was a beautiful aircraft, but I had to make, in the finality, that decision. When one's faced with a problem like this, there is a higher source of strength. If one doesn't have the strength, he can never bear the attacks made on him. I knew that a great industry that had been established would be weakened, but it was right to end it." End quote. The irony of the cost of the Avro Aero program comes in the costs associated with its replacements. The Canadian government would buy 66 second-hand Voodoo fighters that could only go half the speed of the Aero. The country then opted into the BORMAC program, a surface-to-air guided missile system program. That system would be met with immense criticism in the 1960s with the growing anti-nuclear movement, and Canada would choose to abandon its armed forces from nuclear roles, and it would shut down the BORMAC system. In the end, the cost of the Voodoo aircraft and the missile system amounted to more than the entire cost of the Aero program. The cancellation of the program and the purchase of the missiles and the Voodoo fighters would hurt Diefenbaker politically, as well as progressive conservatives. Even 3 years after the cancellation, conservative candidates were dealing with angry Canadians, especially in southern Ontario, speaking about the loss of the Aero. By 1962, Diefenbaker would see his record-setting majority reduced to a minority government. 1 year later, his government was out of power as the Liberals were elected and would lead Canada almost uninterrupted until 1984. By 1967, Diefenbaker was out as leader of his party, and he would spend the rest of his life until his death in 1979 as a backbench member of parliament. The demise of the Avro Aero was disastrous for the company. Crawford Gordon Jr. would resign as president on July 2, 1959, and he would die from alcoholism on January 26, 1967. The vice president of the company, Fred Smee, resigned in 1959. By the time the company closed its doors in 1962, 25,000 people had lost their jobs, with assets sold for $15.6 million. The greatest impact was on the future of Canada. With the program cancelled, many of those thousands of engineers went to find work elsewhere, and that took them to Great Britain, where they worked for the Concorde program, while others went to the United States and began to work for NASA. Jim Chamberlain would take 25 engineers to NASA's Space Task program to become project managers, lead engineers, and more on the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs. Eventually, 32 Avro engineers were part of the program.
And the consequences? One of them was a shot in the arm for the American Moon Project. A number of top engineers were immediately snapped up by NASA. Brian Erb, a young engineer, developed the heat shield for the Apollo spacecraft. Len Packham, in charge of the rocket test program with Avro, worked on the telemetry system for the first manned rocket launchings. And Jim Chamberlain, chief technician at Avro, was project director for Gemini and is now with McDonnell Douglas in Houston. Engineer Ken Cook went from Avro straight to McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis. He's now a systems engineer on the F-18, which his company hopes to sell to Canada for $2.5 billion. It seems the era of the manned interceptor is not over after all. But it's unlikely we'll ever have another Aero. Shortly after the cancellation, we signed a defense production sharing agreement with the U.S., tacitly agreeing never again to undertake production of a major weapon system on our own.
Avro employees would also hold reunions through the years, and Paul Stevens, a producer of the future Aero miniseries, would say, quote, "You sit there in a hotel room full of white-haired men and listen to their testimony. These are people who went to land a man on the moon, but they would say working on the Aero was the best time of their lives. This was the spirit of enthusiasm and creativity at Avro that they never felt again. You could just tell it was like the Apple Corporation of the 1950s. End quote. Pieces of the Avro Aero have turned up over the years and found their way into museums. The Canadian Air and Space Conservancy has a full-sized replica of the plane, while the Avro Museum in Calgary has a flying replica. There's also the nose section of the original Aero with the words "cut here" written on it on display at the Canadian Aviation and Space Museum in Ottawa. In 1997, a miniseries called Aero was released on CBC. The four-hour miniseries starred Dan Aykroyd as Crawford Gordon. The miniseries was highly acclaimed by viewers and historians and won several Gemini Awards that year. It also spawned a Heritage Minute about the Avro Aero.
You know the story, when the RCAF said Mach 2 fighter, two-place, 1,000-mile range, the British said it was impossible. The Yanks tried twice and failed. They said, you're dreaming. We said, fine, we'll build it right here in Toronto. And now you guys, my guys, are saying that it can't be done, that they were right?
Now that's the rocket that we used to get the model up to speed, and then the onboard sensor tells me...
Come on, baby.
Damn it! But we did it according to your specs. The specs have changed.
We did it.
Arrow 201. You cleared for takeoff.
We did it!
Although the government canceled the project and destroyed the prototypes, the Avro Arrow remains for Canada a world benchmark in aerospace achievement.
Aykroyd would offer his own view of the program, stating, quote, I can see why the program was canceled. Missiles were coming in. There was pressure from the United States not to have an aerospace program in Canada. I can't blame old Devil D for that. But where do I blame him is the vindictive and vengeful way the planes were destroyed. That one or two weren't saved is the real black horror of the story. End quote. In February 2004, the pilot who took the Arrow to the skies, Zarakowski, would die of a rare blood disorder at his home in Barry's Bay, Ontario. In September of 2017, a group called Raise the Arrow found an arrow-shaped object in Lake Ontario. The plane was recovered the next year and was believed that it was not one of the scale models that were built, but an earlier, smaller test plane. On January 6, 2020, CBC News announced that the original blueprints of the Avro Arrow were kept by Ken Barnes, a senior draftsman. Ordered to destroy the blueprints, he put them in storage for decades instead. The blueprints were put on display at the Diefenbaker Canada Centre in the Touch the Sky, the story of the Avro Canada program. In 2021, the National Research Council of Canada digitized and released 595 Avro Arrow reports that have been stored in their rare book room. The Avro Arrow private street commemorates the plane and program at the Ottawa Macdonald Cartier International Airport. I hope you enjoyed that episode and my look at the Avro Arrow. Next week, there's no episode because it's Christmas, but the following week, I will be looking at the 1939 Royal Tour. If you like, you can email me at craig@canadaehx.com. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is Craig Baird, CRAIGBAIRD, and I'm on Instagram at Bairdo37. As well, again, if you want to support the podcast, you can for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. And you can donate to the podcast by going to CanadaEHX.com and clicking Donate. I'd also like to thank all of my wonderful patrons, and I apologize if I get any names incorrect. Vobs, Robert Page, Richard D., Colin Johnson, Katie Caldwell, Jeff Hershey, Kyle Murray, Steve Paikin, Matthew Garthaud, Lionel Romaine, Dr. Bob Turner, an anonymous patron that I truly do appreciate, Randy Hayden, Doug Campbell, Reg W., Deborah Carlson, Francis Helbling, Nick Zinri, Shannon Marshall, Clinton Martinez, Dimitri Chauve, Aaron O'Hara Myers, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Rawa, Luke S., J.P. Bear, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, and Iris Gray. Information from Maclean's, Canadian Encyclopedia, the Montreal Gazette, Wikipedia, the National Post, Saskatoon Star Phoenix, Regina Leader Post, Vancouver Province, Calgary Herald, the Windsor Star, CBC, and the Nanaimo Daily News. Thanks. We'll see you again next time.